And welcome to the AVIA presentation, which, as many of you know, is a little bit different today from that which was originally advertised. We expected to hear from a UK barrister about some of the issues confronting law students and lawyers in the UK and about similarities and differences in their experience to ours. But that didn't work out. Instead, we're all very, very, very lucky to have in his stead two very, very wonderful advocates who have done so much for the blindness community and for ACB members over the years. And they are Tori Atkinson and Rosie Lee Bichel from Disability Rights Advocates. I need not tell you about DRA. Anybody who has followed the civil rights efforts and the advocacy efforts of our organization knows what a central role DRA has played in so many pivotal cases, in so many key settlement agreements, and so much other diverse good advocacy. We're going to talk today, hopefully, about a number of factors which are of topical interest. First of all, though, I want to give you the opening CEU credit for this session. It's 29505. That's 29505. And I'll give you the closing credit at the end, so please stay awake. We're also hoping to hear from our friend Chris Bell in a few minutes. I also want to mention that many of you had expected that this session would include AVIA's annual business meeting. But we're going to defer the annual business meeting for the sake of giving these presenters all the time that they need, or as much time as we have, and to facilitate the discussion in the wake of their remarks. Anybody who's not a member of AVIA, but who would like to attend the business meeting, we hope that many of you will. Anyone who's not a member of AVIA, who won't get automatically the notice when we reschedule it, which will be soon, please contact me to indicate your interest, and I'll make sure that you are personally and directly apprised of the time when we schedule the business meeting for. It's Steve Mendelson. My phone number is 510-357-1844. You can also email at Stephen Mendelson, at panix.com. Smendel@panix.com. So thank you very much. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to our esteemed guests, to whom we're especially grateful for stepping into the breach at the last minute and giving us a very valuable session today. So Tori and Rosie, why don't you take it away?
Thank you so much. This is Tori Atkinson. I thank you so much for that lovely introduction. I am sorry I do not have a beautiful British accent. So I hope you're not too disappointed, but we're excited to be here and to talk a little bit about the work that we've done, particularly on behalf of ACB members. So as I said, I'm Tori. I'm a staff attorney with Disability Rights Advocates. I've been here for about 3 years, and I do litigation in this area. I've been doing the APS litigation, accessible pedestrian signals, which we'll talk about soon. And I also do litigation on behalf of students with diabetes and the inaccessible New York City subway system. So really all kinds of areas. Rosie?
Hi, everyone. My name is Rosie Bichel. I'm a Justice Catalyst Fellowship attorney at DRA, and I've been at DRA for almost 2 years now. Like Tori said, we have had the pleasure of representing ACB affiliates and members in a lot of different issues. I personally have been able to represent ACB members and affiliates in the context of voting access litigation. I also spend a lot of my time working on challenging punitive conditions and unconstitutional conditions of confinement, especially for people with disabilities in immigration detention centers across the nation. So that's a brief rundown of my work. And I'll pass it back to Tori to kick us off, I guess, on DRA generally.
Yeah, so you might have heard of us. We are a nonprofit organization that works on behalf of people with all kinds of disabilities in all kinds of areas. And as the introduction made clear, we work with ACB affiliates all over. I have the pleasure of working with the ACB of New York. But we have done cases related to people who are blind in areas of pedestrians, in we have a settlement agreements with Hulu, Netflix, HBO, and AMC theaters related to audio description. We have done sidewalks cases related to detectable warnings and tactile paving in New York, and we have ongoing litigation in Philly and Baltimore. We have done website accessibility with the New York Department of Elections, with an emergency alert system in New York. And also, we have a case on behalf of the Lighthouse regarding the inaccessibility of ADP, which is a type of accounting software. We've worked on app accessibility. So we sued the San Jose Sharks because their app for hockey, if you don't know, was inaccessible. And we've also done things like emergency preparedness, which became more and more necessary after Hurricane Sandy and a bunch of other natural disasters, to make sure that there are plans in place for evacuations. And the pandemic has brought forth issues like remote learning and its inaccessibility. And then, as Rosie said, we also do work in detention facilities. So she's working on ICE. I'm working on issues in adult prisons. And we've also had cases in for juveniles, both in adult and non-adult context. So we wanted to kick it off with voting. Rosie has been doing some amazing work about voting rights across the country. So Rosie, why don't you take that away?
Sure. This is Rosie again. Thank you, Tori. So for some general background on the voting, the more recent voting access work that DRA has pursued, we, in the last year and a half or so, initiated litigation in several states addressing inaccessible absentee voting programs. That was in Indiana, New York, and North Carolina. I'll talk briefly about all of them, but then we'll focus a lot of my time on North Carolina. So each of these states, like many others, had print-only absentee voting programs in place, which I don't know if I have to tell everyone here. I'm sure everyone is aware, but that generally forces blind voters and other voters with print disabilities to forfeit the privacy and independence of their vote if they do choose to vote absentee, thereby excluding them from those voters with disabilities from absentee voting programs in violation of federal disability law. So not only in Indiana specifically, not only was their program print-based, but Indiana did not even provide voters with the choice in who would assist them. And per state law, voters seeking assistance to mark their absentee ballots were required to request what they call a traveling board, which is comprised of two volunteers from local county elections agencies who would come to their home and who would then mark the ballot for the voter. Typically, these would be people who the voter would not know, and so they would be required to divulge their vote to people who they did not know. So these barriers were all pretty longstanding, but they became ever more apparent during the COVID-19 pandemic, when voters were forced to choose between their health and exposure to COVID-19 versus the privacy and independence of their ballot if they were in states where they had accessible in-person voting. So now, speaking a little bit more specifically about North Carolina, we filed this suit last July, and in our complaint, we described the North Carolina State Board of Elections' exclusion of voters with disabilities from the absentee voting program, as I described, based on their print-based program. In that case, we represented the ACB state affiliate, as well as the North Carolina Protection Advocacy Organization, in addition to several individual plaintiffs. And we often, in a lot of our cases, have that sort of organizational and individual configuration of clients, because that way when we have organizations with, for example, statewide membership of voters with disabilities or people who are blind, then that ensures that we have standing should the individuals need to leave the case. But then we also we tend to have individual plaintiffs as well, whose personal experience with the barriers we seek to address, who have personal experience with the barriers we seek to address, and who demonstrate different facets of the community and the community's experience of the problem. So back to North Carolina specifically, we originally filed suit in July. And then in our complaint, we called for the State Board of Elections to provide accommodations to voters with disabilities such that they could vote privately and independently from home. This included fully accessible electronic voting mechanisms, as well as alternate format print ballots, including Braille and large print. We followed up with a preliminary injunction calling for relief for the 2020 general election, given the short turnaround. And in September of last year, the Eastern District of North Carolina granted our preliminary injunction, ordering that the North Carolina State Board of Elections expand the accessible electronic absentee mechanism, which they already had in place for overseas and military voters, to blind voters and other voters with print disabilities. There was pretty short turnaround between the granting of the PI and the election. However, it still expanded access to the absentee voting program such that many voters were able to vote privately and independently absentee in the 2020 general election. Because it was a preliminary injunction specific to the 2020 election, we had to return to court for permanent relief. And so we subsequently filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And that was granted only slightly more than a month ago, which was a really great victory. So now North Carolina is required to permanently provide accessible electronic absentee voting, also known as remote accessible vote by mail, in addition to providing alternate format print ballots and accommodations more broadly for voters with disabilities. They're also required to make their website, WCAG, accessible and provide some training and direction to county boards on voting accessibility. So that was a great victory in North Carolina. That came about without legislation. As I'm sure you are all aware, there has been a recent wave of state voting legislation that implicates the exercise of the franchise by blind voters and other voters with disabilities in multiple ways. Some of these changes have been positive. For example, West Virginia and Indiana recently passed laws seeking to make remote electronic voting more available. However, a lot of these changes have been negative. Some of these include the recent Georgia bill restricting many voting locations and methods of voting and restricting how what kind of assistance can be provided to folks waiting in line to vote. And these rules at this point will have great impact on people with disabilities. In a myriad of ways. I would say for folks who are more interested in the wide-ranging state legislation, Clark Rochefeld, the ACB's Director of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs, is giving a presentation, I believe, tomorrow at noon Eastern Time, and he may be covering some of these issues. There's also some more information about broader legislation on the ACB website, as well as via the National Coalition on Accessible Voting. And so with that, I believe that concludes my report on voting. And I will pass it back to Tori to talk about some of our other cases. And I will mention, we will have time for questions about everything we're talking about at the end of our presentation. But right now I can have a few minutes. If folks have voting specific questions, I'd be happy to answer for maybe about 5 minutes.
Rosie, I have a question. Steve here. It's almost more than an issue of comment. Given how long any kind of systems change often takes, what amazes me about the recent voting rights successes coming so close as they did to the election or the primary, depending on the state, was how fast we were able to implement positive change. It's quite a refreshing exception to the usual slow pace of things.
Absolutely. And I mean, there may have been several factors that played a role there. It's hard to say exactly what it was, but at least in North Carolina, the fact that there was already an accessible electronic mechanism in place for other voters sped up the process in increasing access there. It's hard to say why else it is going on besides the fact that this has been kind of a general, there's been a movement across the nation for pushing these kinds of voting changes. And so for that, we are really grateful to be part of that broader movement.
When the dam breaks, the water flows.
Yeah. Rosie, this is Chris Bell. I just wondered if you'd address the issue of why it's difficult to attack witness requirements. North Carolina had witness requirements in their statute, partly as a result of some election fraud done by the GOP, where they got solicited absentee ballots from people and marked them in favor of the GOP candidate and sent them in. And so the state imposed a requirement for two witnesses or a notary public. They dropped that down to one witness or a notary public for the 2020 election. How is that difficult to challenge under the ADA and 504?
Thanks, Chris. So it is difficult in several ways. One is that it's hard to crystallize. So witness requirements are generally burdensome, and it's hard to crystallize in a way that's compelling for courts how much more burdensome witness requirements are for blind voters and other voters with disabilities. So that was a tricky part there. And in North Carolina specifically, because voting fraud has become such a, or the specter of voting fraud has become such a hot button and politicized issue, the state legislation was incredibly focused on having what they see as these extra protections, even if in practice they don't necessarily afford the kinds of protections against voter fraud that the state legislature believes that they do. So there are several factors there, and those are a few of them. But there are, we do hope to try to address issues such as witness requirements going forward, though generally legislation is and legislative advocacy, which is falls outside the purview of DRA at least, is likely the most effective route to address that.
Just as an aside, where notary public involvement is required in this or other states, there's actually now one major company that's offering remote notary services.
Which is, I mean, that's sorry, did you said there is a state that is offering remote notary services, or did you ask if there are
states? Company, a national company. So if someone is in a state where notarization is required to complete the election process, it may be possible to utilize virtual services of a notary as well.
Absolutely. And I'm glad to hear about that. I wonder how that's played out in voting so far.
Well, it's new. They just apparently announced it in the last couple of weeks.
So I guess it's
DocuSign or a subsidiary thereof.
This is Tori. I'm actually also a notary and have really enjoyed, in New York, there was an executive order that permitted virtual notarization, which was truly a game changer. And I believe now they are talking about passing bills to make it permanent. So I would love to see that, particularly in the voting context where you're talking about something that is so unbelievably critical.
All right. So maybe if we have another minute or so for questions right now before we move on to some other topics.
Well, let me go on to our next topic. That was very helpful. And let's go on to our next topic now, and which I'm sure will do just as much so.
This is Tori. I see there is a hand up. Was there another question just before we get to me?
I'm sorry, I was muted. John, you may unmute.
Ah, there we go. Thank you. Rosie, I joined shortly after the session started, so I didn't get the full name of your group. But what I want to ask is, in your work with dealing with alternative ways to vote rather than the paper ballot, I assume you've run across concerns about security, and I'm wondering how you have dealt with those concerns.
Thanks for asking that question, John. We have indeed run across some of those concerns. Generally speaking, we have dealt with them. We have been able to consult with some voting tech experts on this, and we've dealt with those concerns by a number of ways. A main one being that when electronic voting is expanded to, so in North Carolina specifically, the state did try to raise the issue of of security in electronic voting. We were able to push back on that because they were already offering the electronic voting to some voters. It was not so that kind of undermined their security question there because they already found it secure enough to offer to uniform and to military and overseas voters. And then when you're tacking on voters for whom print format is not accessible, that again is while a significant group, it's not a huge huge voting group, and so it doesn't it doesn't necessarily pose a quote unquote honeypot for purposes of hacking. There also are several purpose built remote accessible vote by mail platforms that have myriad security measures in place, and in the actual marking of the ballot, it's done locally on individual computers and individual networks, rather than via the large connected internet network. And so those are several ways that we dealt with the security questions there. There have been no issues since the electronic voting was implemented for the 2020 election in North Carolina. There haven't been any security issues that have arisen.
You have no other questions.
All right. So I guess now I do see actually one other hand up for a 5-0.
That's Steve's hand.
Oh, okay. Never mind then. All right. So I will then pass it on to Tori.
Thanks, Rosie. So I wanted to talk a little bit about accessible pedestrian signals. I talked about this at the last in-person ACB conference? I know it might not be. It was 2019, I think, when it was in Rochester.
Okay. All right.
So I may have met some of you there to talk about this, but so we have a case in New York and we have a case in Chicago, and the New York case was the first one. We represent the American Council of the Blind New York chapter, the New York affiliate, and we have individuals. So we have a person who's blind and a person who is deafblind as our plaintiffs. And in this case, this was something that had been brewing in the community for a while. And let me just kind of take a step back and talk a little bit about what accessible pedestrian signals are. They are vibrotactile and audio devices that are affixed to crossings, to street crossings, that make sound and vibrate when the walk sign is on and when the walk sign is not on. So it gives certainty to you when you're deciding whether or not to cross. And they've existed since the 1950s. I mean, the old versions were called bird calls because they sound a little bit like birds, which is difficult to suss out in the environment, but the more recent ones sound they go like bup, 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 which is very, very distinct, and they're commonplace in other countries, and they have been commonplace and kind of rolling out over the last 30 years in some cities in the United States. I think San Francisco has a lot of them, and then a lot of states have adopted them as well. I think Maryland has, and a lot of cities like Phoenix and DC has a lot, and Austin, I think. So essentially what they do is it emits a locator tone so that you can find the crossing point. And then you push the button, which will also vibrate if you're deafblind. And it will vibrate and tell you that the walk sign is on when the walk signal has changed. So this has become increasingly important in intersections that are not predictable and not regular. This has been especially an issue since the rollout of Vision Zero, which you may have heard of if you're in one of many cities that has adopted it. It is essentially a platform of policies to reduce pedestrian injuries and deaths from cars. But one of the central sort of remedies or innovations, they would probably say, for reducing pedestrian injuries and fatalities is what's called a leading pedestrian interval, which is really just a fancy way of saying when the pedestrian light comes on before the car traffic gets the green light. And so what that means is usually pedestrians have, you know, a 7 to 10 second lead. But if you're waiting for a parallel surge, you've just missed your crossing window, and you wind up deciding to cross at the moment that cars think that the pedestrian phase is over and will turn into you. So this sort of innovation has actually made a lot of urban environments much more dangerous for blind pedestrians than they were before. And that kind of renewed a lot of advocacy around this. And in New York, there was a broad coalition of advocates who went to the city. They wrote a letter to then Mayor Bloomberg, just to give you a sense of how long ago this was. And it had ACB, it had NFB, it had various independent living centers, various rehab centers, just a huge coalition of people saying, you know, this is making streets less safe. You have an obligation under the law to make these intersections accessible to us who are blind. Just because we can't see the signal doesn't mean we're not entitled to have that information. And so they did an incredible amount of advocacy. And the city did very little in response. So a local law was passed that mandated that they install 25 a year and then ultimately 75 a year. But New York City is a city with 13,200 intersections. And they were installing as many as 100 new signals a year, which also weren't accessible. So the city would have never become accessible. And while the city, you know, met with advocates and, you know, had quarterly meetings and said, we're working on it. By the time we filed the lawsuit in 2018, and this is 8 years after advocacy had begun, there were only 3% of intersections had accessible pedestrian signals. That was the result of 8 years of, you know, truly stupendous advocacy work. And so that's when we get involved. And, you know, we always tell people that advocacy comes first. Litigation, as I forgot who mentioned it this earlier in this, it takes forever. It is uncertain. So, you know, we always encourage people to do advocacy first. But here they had done it. And it hadn't changed. So we came in, we filed the case in 2018, and we had several different sort of angles about why what they were doing was illegal and discriminated against people's vision disabilities. The first thing was under the ADA, a city has to provide meaningful access to its services, programs, and activities. So we said, this isn't meaningful access. Only 3% of intersections are accessible. This isn't enough to get from point A to point B. This isn't enough to be able to safely access streets. And meanwhile, they're letting out like 500 to 1,000 new LPIs every year that are, you know, spreading this across the city, but not necessarily in a predictable way so that a blind pedestrian would have any idea whether an intersection even had an LPI. So that was the first piece, was the current state of inaccessibility is so catastrophically low that it does not provide meaningful access to people with vision disabilities. The second thing that we challenged was this installing new intersections without APS. And I know you guys are lawyers, which is fantastic. And you may know that the ADA had sort of a grand bargain, right? And the grand bargain was you have to provide meaningful access today. You need that as soon as possible. You need to provide meaningful access today. But we won't make you install it everywhere. We won't make you make every single feature of every single thing of life accessible right away. That would, you know, they said it would cost too much. But the grand bargain was, you know, when you decide to upgrade something, when you install something new, when you choose to spend money to improve a feature, then you have to make it accessible. And it doesn't matter what it costs. That is your obligation going forward. And so in this case, the city had done neither. They hadn't provided meaningful access, but they had also been installing, you know, 100 to 150 brand new signals every year without accessible pedestrian signals. And then similarly, they would do these massive renovations, spend millions of dollars to reconfigure intersections, to add bike lanes, to do all the stuff that, you know, departments of transportation, I think, have been eager to do in the last 10 years, but they wouldn't make it accessible. And so, you know, those were kind of the three legal claims that we used to hopefully push the city to take action. So it took 2 years of litigation. It was aggressively litigated. And last October, our judge ruled in favor of ACB and said, you know what, you're right. This doesn't provide meaningful access. And by the time of that decision, 5% of the intersections were accessible. So in those 2 years, they had increased the percentage by 2%. And the judge was not impressed and said, how can you tell me 5% is meaningful access? That's one in 20 intersections, you know, and the danger is so significant. I mean, if you believe you are crossing at the right time and you are not, that is an incredibly dangerous situation. So the judge acknowledged that. He listened to the stories that our plaintiffs had about their horrific experiences just trying to get to work, to see their friends, to go shopping, to do whatever it is that, you know, people want to do in their lives, and how it was just a daily struggle. You know, either asking, having to rely on strangers for help and advice, which of course, you know, denies you your independence in a certain way. Not everyone in New York is very helpful is another piece of it. You know, or essentially guessing and guessing wrong. It's just, it's a really stressful position to be in. So he agreed that there was no meaningful access. He agreed that, they had been illegally installing new intersections without making them accessible. We didn't quite win on the renovations piece because he wanted more information about the scope of the renovations. But, you know, after that, he ordered us to essentially attempt to settle the case. We attempted to settle it. We could not. And so we get to the second phase, which is remedy. So we have a judgment that says this system is illegal, it's discriminatory, it's unsafe. What do we do about it? And that is always the bigger question, right? It's what is reasonable, what they can pay for, what they can afford. And so this 2021 has been the year of remedy. So we submitted competing remedial plans. We got a slew of community letters from ACB, American Foundation. I mean, from all these different organizations, basically trying to impress upon the court how important this is because, you know, our judge is a sighted guy. He doesn't really understand what this means day to day. So, you know, we got a lot of community support. We submitted our proposed remedial plan, and essentially the city's plan would make the city accessible in zones. They want to create what they call zones of accessibility, which I think sounds rather dystopian, where they will make all intersections in a particular neighborhood accessible and then do it neighborhood by neighborhood, and that it will take between 30 and 40 years to make the city accessible. So we obviously said that was completely inadequate. It's inappropriate. You don't prioritize people against each other like that, neighborhoods against each other. It leads to profound inequities. So where we are with that is we are waiting for the judge to rule on a remedy. And I wish I knew what it would be, but you'll have to stay tuned for that next time. And yeah, that's basically the New York case. And just briefly, a year later, after we filed this in 2018, we filed a similar case in Chicago, Metropolitan ACB of Chicago. And there, the Chicago situation was catastrophically worse. Chicago had a total of 15 intersections that had APS. 15. And so we filed a lawsuit there as well. And recently, the Department of Justice intervened and said, you know, this is discriminatory. We agree with the plaintiffs. You know, we want to be part of the case. We need to enforce the ADA. They're violating the law. And they also wound up filing a statement of interest in our New York case. Of course, you know, we're in a much more advanced stage of the litigation. But yeah, that's basically the status. And, you know, it's been an interesting ride, because I think that these issues they're appearing everywhere, right? I mean, all these cities are trying to create a safer pedestrian experience. They're investing lots of money. We're talking about a massive infrastructure bill that might be coming through Congress, lots and lots of money. And we're trying to make sure that, you know, if you spend that money, you have to make features accessible. That's what the law requires. It's what's right. It's what's just. But, you know, we're 30 years post ADA, and we're still fighting for that. It's kind of outrageous that this is something that needs to be said. But yeah, I mean, that's the gist. Thank you
much on that, Tori. This is Chris Bell. A couple of points I want to make. First of all, the fact that there is going to be infrastructure money, a fairly significant amount, makes it very important for advocates at the local level, where decisions will be made as to what will be done on different streets and different intersections. We have to be involved in that at the local level to make sure and remind the departments of transportation that they have an obligation to install accessible pedestrian signals. That's one point. Second point is that while this has been going on a parallel track, the Federal Highway Administration, which is a component of the U.S. Department of Transportation, has issued proposed amendments to the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. The Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices sets out the standards for various traffic control devices, including accessible pedestrian signals. However, the manual has never required the installation of accessible pedestrian signals. It recognizes with regard to leading pedestrian intervals and something similar called exclusive pedestrian intervals, that people with vision loss are extremely endangered and disadvantaged by these systems. But it still, although it recognizes this and acknowledges it, does not require them. So ACB and other organizations have vociferously commented on these proposed amendments, and ACB also wrote a letter to Secretary Buttigieg of the Department of Transportation, setting forth all of the harms that result from the failure of the federal government to require accessible pedestrian signals. And finally, there really is not a lot of case law on this. So there is a published decision out of the Eastern District of New York, which you can find on Westlaw. And also Lori Scharf and Mike Godneau litigated over one intersection in Long Island. So this is a very important, this notion that we can attack a lack of accessible pedestrian signals systemically is extremely significant. And I just want people to recognize that. Thank you.
I'm really glad you mentioned that. I mean, the local level is so critical. The coalition that came about in New York is the Pedestrians for Accessible and Safe Streets, and they came about after the letter and after there was an action on the letter to the mayor. And they have been dogging on them, on legislatures, on the DOT, and that kind of pressure makes an enormous difference. I mean, if that pressure hadn't existed, there wouldn't have been a city council law mandating any, right? And that was because advocates got got together. They testified at hearings. They invited elected officials to blindfold try and cross the street to give them a sense of the level of danger. Obviously, they're not trained independent travelers, but, you know, put a little fear into them so they understand. They did all of that work that really laid the groundwork for it. And in terms of the money that's coming down, I mean, that is really critical. And it's really critical to have these multi-pronged approaches. The MUTCD is a really good example. I mean, that is a very technical thing. The most people don't know about it. It's a technical manual, right? But it doesn't speak to APS in that way. It doesn't recognize that. And part of that is because there's such a gap at the federal level with evolving technologies in the ADA. And this is part of the problem with web accessibility too, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But, you know, they haven't, They promulgated draft guidelines about pedestrian rights of way that would require APS. They promulgated that 10 years ago, and the regulations have not taken effect. There was, of course, a lot of opposition from DOTs, but a lot of support from the disability community and various disability communities, honestly, because it also involves curb cuts and things like that. And yet there's been no action on it. So, you know, this is one of those ways where there's a vacuum, because what people understood about accessibility in 1990 when the ADA was passed is pretty different than the technology that exists today. I mean, when I talk about LPIs, these leading pedestrian intervals, in the before times, that was a physical change. You used to have to send an electrician out to a traffic signal, open up the signal box, you know, rotate physical dials and press physical buttons. Now you can do that with a USB key that has software loaded onto it. And so this is one of the areas where the law hasn't really kept up. And that's why, you know, it's fantastic that ACB and other orgs have really been trying to push to get to have the courts fill the gaps where the legislature didn't. So, you know, the very first APS case was, yeah, Lori Scharf and Mike Adino in Long Island. They only challenged a handful of intersections. I think it was somewhere between 5 and 10. It was a small number. And the New York case was the very first APS litigation of a whole city. And, you know, our hope is that this fills in those gaps in federal law, that this establishes in some way a standard that's a warning to all of the other cities. If you better get with this, you know, this is the future, right? And the future has to be accessible, and you can start now, or you can wait until your community and your advocates come after you and sue you. So that's very much my hope about where this is going.
Corey, another aspect of why consumer activism and involvement on the local level is so important is illustrated by the fact that New York City is the past master at desultory, expensive, and endless litigation. New York City, if they don't get a remedy which is satisfactory to them, which means almost by definition not satisfactory to us, will appeal. And they'll appeal again, and they'll appeal again. Anyone who's ever ridden the subway knows that case has been going on for well over 300 years and is likely to continue for a while. So even though we all believe in litigation as an important strategy and an important galvanizing force for good and for change, we have to never forget that lying behind that and parallel to it, advocacy, political work, and nonstop effort on the community level are often indispensable situations where a huge bureaucracy can defer the activity for years.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I appreciate that. And, you know, I'm a lawyer. You're all lawyers. I love suing people. That's what I love to do. But it's a tool. It's one of many tools that can be used to achieve an outcome. And I'm on the subways case, so I feel that one very acutely. But, you know, there is progress. I mean, so one of the things that you may know is that Tammy Duckworth, a senator with a disability, has introduced a bill in the Senate, and there's now a companion bill in the House called the ASAP Act, which is specifically about rapid transit and commuter rails. And it came from a kind of horrifying realization that here we are 30 years after the ADA, and yet the vast majority of these legacy systems, these systems that existed before the ADA were passed, are horrifically inaccessible. And in her bill, that would provide 80% federal reimbursement to municipalities and to agencies that add accessibility features. And that includes not just elevators, but includes things like tactile paving, braille signage, I mean, all kinds of audio announcements, right? All these kinds of things that, again, have sort of, they seem obvious, and you wouldn't think that they would be so hard, but the real hope is that with kind of money backing it up, there will be more of an incentive to provide it. And, it's a no-brainer. Accessibility helps everybody. Everybody benefits from audio announcements, from better signage, from, I mean, it's just, it's really silly that these things have taken so long, but it wouldn't happen without that kind of advocacy. And, you remember that you have a voice and you have power, and it can be a little scary sometimes to kind of confront. I mean, you guys are lawyers, so you're probably fine with it. But a lot of advocates I talk to are a little nervous about it. And it's like, no, these are your rights and this is your world and you live in it too. And the world, you deserve to have a world that meets your needs. So, I couldn't agree more.
Great. Well, thank you. What topic shall we take up next?
I think there's a question.
I was going to just ask if you wanted to take the question.
Sure.
Okay. Charles, you may unmute.
Hi. In 2017, ACB adopted a resolution that requested that CGMs, devices to measure blood sugar levels, be accessible. And that was because, diabetes is a major cause of blindness and also, at that time, the third leading cause of death because of the adverse effects that diabetes has on other parts of the body. Now, there have been apps developed so that some of the CGMs, constant monitoring glucose devices, can be accessed. But, many blind people can't afford iPhones or anything, things like that. So what we really want is to have these devices to be accessible out of the package, so you don't have to rely on an iPhone. What is being done in that area?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because I actually represent the American Diabetes Association as well in a case involving the New York City school system and its failure to provide accommodations to students with diabetes. I was not familiar with that. I know that they have smartphone apps and that if depending on the CGM, right, like they're evolving every day, and we're getting now into a world of closed loop systems and very, very cool technology. But I wasn't aware that they're inaccessible to people who are blind. I would love it if you would send me an email. My email is TATKINSON at dralegal.org. I wasn't aware of that. And I'll certainly pass that along. That's a really interesting and important point.
I think I can elaborate on that, Charles, unless you want to. There are two major kinds of continuous glucose monitoring devices, CGMs, as they're called, as I understand it. The main one is the Dexcom, and now one that gets a lot of play is the Abbott. Now, the Dexcom certainly has the capacity to output readings to an iPhone, and many people do that. But as Charles says, the iPhone is expensive, and not everyone has either the money or the technical skill to use it, especially given that diabetes can cause loss of sensory capability in hands and fingers, which would make using an iPhone all the more difficult. Now, for a while, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services actually barred use of iPhones for that purpose. They barred people from using their CGM devices to output to an iPhone. The reasons for that were complex and shrouded in controversy and history, but primarily due to pressure from parents who wanted to have easy access to their children's readings. Nobody cared about us, mind you. But due to a tremendous amount of advocacy by parents who wanted access to their children's readings, the CMS relaxed that rule. So for somebody who can afford an iPhone and knows how to use it, then there's no problem. But that's only a very small percentage of the people who are at issue, as you say.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I didn't realize that. I mean, I know the Freestyle has kind of a separate external device that isn't an iPhone, but anyway, that's a really interesting point. I mean, this, I think, just shows again where what happens when you have gaps in federal regulations. I mean, that there's no federal requirement to make those devices accessible. And so that's my guess about why that is. But I think the technology is evolving pretty quickly, and hopefully advocacy can make a big difference there. So I want to recognize the time. It is 3:22. I was just going to mention briefly some of our app and web accessibility cases. So this is a really great transition. As I mentioned before, we challenged the web accessibility of the New York Department of Elections. You couldn't even register to vote, which was obviously a problem. We have a lawsuit on behalf of the Lighthouse regarding ADP software. We have the case against the Sharks. There's something that we are looking at now that I'd be curious to hear from folks about. My understanding is that a lot of medical practices, including my own, have developed these kind of My Chart, My Health apps in order to access your medical records, in order to communicate with your doctor. And many of these apps are completely inaccessible. So that's something we're looking at. And if that's something that you've experienced, definitely send me an email or give me a call. And my information is on the website. I'm happy to share it after the fact as well. But that's something that we're looking into. And we also saw this we're a little late on this now, but we also heard about this in the context of the COVID vaccination program, that some of the websites for signing up to receive vaccines were not accessible. But the other thing generally, though, is that, like, as with, you know, intersections, as with everything, apps are the future, right? And they're, in many cases, a lot cheaper than real infrastructure or other kinds of services. And so, you know, we have some concerns that in an effort to cut corners, save money, reduce costs, that a lot of municipalities, a lot of organizations, private and public, are going to kind of switch to apps to do things. And so, you know, given that, once again, apps are something that there is no federal regulation about, well, there's limited federal regulation, but, you know, given that kind of gap, it's really going to be up to the community and up to advocates to hold people's feet to the fire and ensure that these apps are made accessible.
Hello?
I didn't know if there were any questions about that.
Oh, Tori, just a quick comment on that. One of the ironies here, again, is that apps are, on average, much easier to make accessible. Trouble to do it. But with respect to the question of the healthcare portals, with respect to those, and with respect to the self-service kiosks that are now popping up in all kinds of healthcare facilities, we have to enter all kinds of information in order to get in. I think that both of those raise issues, not only under the ADA, which are obvious, but also as compulsory breaches of confidentiality under HIPAA.
I'm glad I'm not a HIPAA lawyer. I know it's strange. I mean, talk about things that are really easy to make accessible, but, you know, they kind of have to have it drilled into them. And, you know, we have done some other healthcare work. I know Rosie has worked on Hinkle. Rosie, if you wanted to jump in about that briefly.
Absolutely. I can speak to that.
Come in.
Oh, sorry. This is Rosie again. So we, our organization, Disability Rights Advocates, has had the pleasure of representing the California Council of the Blind, in addition to several individuals, in a suit challenging the inaccessibility of Medi-Cal notices, failure to provide notices in inaccessible format for beneficiaries and applicants who are blind or who otherwise for whom print is inaccessible. So that case is still pending, but that's one other area that we've managed to work, litigate and also negotiate around access for ACB members, and it touches on the healthcare space as well.
Thank you, Rosie. And I can say on behalf of CCB, that DRA has done outstanding work in a case where California, again, is really recalcitrant.
You can say that again. It's been a slog.
Put it mildly.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say it is 3:25. I think we definitely want to open it up to questions for folks about anything we've talked about or anything else. Honestly, I'm delighted to hear from fellow attorneys, particularly.
Before we do, may I just say one thing? We have a special guest here today who I want to acknowledge. And it's terribly embarrassing how it happened. I probably shouldn't even reveal it, except that he is here. It turns out that there was a terrible breakdown of communications. And our originally intended speaker has shown up and is on the line. And obviously, we can't hear from him now. We would have loved to, and we're very grateful for what we did here today. But I want to introduce Adal Ibrar and thank him for being here and issue him a promise that next year, since we'll probably be doing a hybrid event next year, we want to have him back either online or in person, as the case may be.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's been very interesting to listen to your speaker. So, certainly, I'll be more than happy to attend next year, either by remote or in person.
That's great. Thank you, Adam. Now, let's go ahead. Yes, with further questions.
Would you like me to tell people how to raise their hand just in case they don't know?
Yeah, please do, Sheila. That'd be great.
Okay. If you're on a PC, it's Alt Y. If you're on a Mac, it's Option Y. If you're on a smartphone, it is on the face of your screen. And if you're on a landline, it is *9. And you have no hands raised yet. So.
Okay. And in our remaining few minutes then, until and unless somebody does raise a hand, Tori, Rosie, are there any other matters that you'd like to bring up? Your work, your scope of your work is so vast. I mean, if this were a restaurant menu, I would die of approach anxiety before ordering.
Absolutely. This is Rosie. I would say, I think that we've already been hearing some interesting possible case ideas, but even though the scope of our work is quite vast, we are always interested to hear from folks on different barriers that they've encountered. Well, I mean, we hope that they're not encountering barriers, but we really welcome any case ideas or thoughts on new areas of advocacy to pursue. So Tori's given her email a few times. I can give mine as well. It's RBICHELL@DRALegal.org. But we're always open to hearing from folks. And I do see, it looks now that there are several hands raised.
Great.
So I don't know who wants to.
Okay. Area code 305, last 3983. You may unmute.
This is my boss, Sheila, on the phone there, taking wonderful care of us. Thank you, Sheila.
Hi, Jim.
This is Jim Crott. Was that TAtkins@DRALlegal.org?
Close. I have a lot more consonants. So it's TAtkinson. At DRALegal.org. You can also Google me. I'm one of the... my name is Tori with an IE, which is pretty unusual. Or you can look up Disability Rights Advocates. Both of our emails should be out there. So
I will forward this to the president of the diabetes affiliate of ACB, a new president, and he's very interested in moving forward with this whole issue of accessible meters and stuff.
Great. I'll look forward to hearing from them.
Thank you.
Okay, Chris Prentice, you may unmute.
Thanks, Sheila. Tori, in your discussions with the City of New York, have y'all approached them with the fact that since they're replacing 100 a year, that if they come forward with making sure that all the new ones are accessible, and then every time they replace a new one, that they would also replace an old one with an accessible system and basically do them an intersection at a time kind of thing?
You mean, did we challenge that or did they change their ways? They did change their ways a little. So after they lost the case, they've started putting in APS at all new intersections. And they've also started installing APS as part of what they call major reconstructions, where you're moving poles or you're putting in a new light. But, you know, we have differences, I think, about the scope of what would trigger the requirement for APS. I mean, our point is, you know, there's a certain point at which it doesn't really matter what the law requires. It makes good financial sense and good city planning sense to just add accessibility when you're doing work anyway. I mean, if you break ground in New York City, it costs $10,000. Why not add a $500 box while you're at it? It's just one of those common sense things that, you know, cities really struggle to understand.
And I'm in Austin, and the way that it works here, basically, they haven't put them in every intersection. But if someone contacts the engineering department and requests one to be put in, like in their neighborhood or whatever, then they'll come in and do that. That way, they're basically almost on demand to where there's actually because a lot of times their argument is, well, who's going to use them? And, you know, some places are going to get used more than others. And obviously, there's a few more people in New York than there are in Austin. But and most of downtown has audible signals, but they're putting them in more in the neighborhoods where a request has been made, where there are, you know, blind or deafblind people in the neighborhood that have, I mean, it just takes one person making a request to get one put in. So.
Oh, I love Austin. That's fantastic. So the issue with New York, which has 200,000 people who are blind, every corner is being used by somebody with a vision disability. So New York ostensibly takes requests, but the problem is they only install now, I think it's 150 a year, and their request backlog is something like 3,500 requests, and it takes them on average more than 3 years to respond to it. So it is just, it's not on demand. We have, you know, ILCs and vision services orgs that have been waiting literally years, sometimes as many as 8 to 9 years to get an APS installed. I wish that it were as efficient as it sounds Austin is.
Tori, is there any recourse under state law?
You know, the New York state law, I mean, it depends on your state, obviously. The New York state law doesn't...
I'm thinking New York, yeah.
Yeah, the New York state law isn't particularly more broad than the ADA. We did sue under the New York City Human Rights Law, and I would definitely urge those of you who are, you know, dealing with accessibility issues or litigators yourself on this issue, look at state and local law, because the New York City law is very, very good. In this case, you know, the conduct violated the ADA anyway, but the bar for the city law is it's very different. You just have to you're entitled to equal access, right, under the city law. So I would definitely encourage folks to do that. And just for interest's sake, the subway lawsuit that we have, we did bring only under city law in state court, because as many of you may know, the legacy transit agencies all received exemptions from the ADA to avoid having to make things accessible.
Okay. John, you may unmute.
Is working. Rosie, could you just repeat your email address, please?
Absolutely. My email address is R as in road, B I C as in cat, H as in hat, E L L at dralegal.org.
Wow, that's tough. R. One more time. R.
R B I C H E L L at D R A.
Got it that time. Thank you.
Great. No problem.
Good folks, we're going to have to wrap up. I want to first remind you, anybody who's not a member of AVIA who wants to attend our business meeting, and I hope you will, please call me at 510-357-1844 or email me at smendel@panics.com, and I'll make sure you know when that meeting is. Otherwise, AVIA members will receive notice. I want to give you the closing CEU code. It's 21128-21128. And obviously, I want to thank our presenters for stepping into the breach and doing such a wonderful job. And I want to thank Sheila, and I want to thank everyone involved in making this possible, and thank our guest Adal as well. So thank you all very much, and we look forward to everyone having a wonderful conference and talking to you again soon. Bye now.